the greedy ones, and the authoritarian ones. Let's shade in the intersecting area in a different color and label it dangerous. Greed isn't automatically dangerous on its own, and petty authoritarians aren't usually dangerous outside their immediate vicinity. But when you combine the two, you get gangsters and dictators and hate-spewing preachers. There is a third philosophy by which, thankfully, only a tiny minority of people live their lives. It's a bit harder to sum up, but it begins like this. In the beginning was the endless void, and the void spawned the elder things, and we were created to be their slaves, and they're going to return to Earth in the near future, and it is only by willingly subordinating ourselves to their merest whim that we can hope to survive. Now let me drop another circle on the diagram, and scribble in the tiny patch where it intersects with the other two circles, and label it in deepest fuliginous black. Here be monsters. Greedy, check. Authoritarian, check. Worshippers of the most bizarre anti-human monsters you can imagine, check. That's the Brotherhood of the Black Pharaoh, and their masks like the Free Church of the Universal Kingdom, and all of their ilk. Hateful, dangerous, unpleasant, greedy, and all-around bad people who you don't want to have anything to do with if you can help it. There's just one problem with this picture. That bit about, in the beginning was the endless void? They're right. Oops. Here's the problem. We live in a hideously reticulated multiverse, where most of the dimensionality of space-time is hidden from our view, curved in on themselves in closed loops, tucked away in imaginary spaces. But the stuff we can observe is a tiny fraction of the entirety of what we live in. Magic, the stuff I deal with in the office on a day-to-day basis, involves the indirect manipulation of information flow through these unseen dimensions, and communication with the extra-dimensional entities that live elsewhere. I'm an applied computational demonologist. How can I not believe this stuff? Not the bit about original creation. Oh no. Beings like Nyarlathotep didn't mold us out of the black clay of the Nile Delta. I've got no beef with modern cosmology, but those of them who take an interest in our kind find it useful for humans to believe such myths, and so they encourage the cultist numpties through their pursuit of forbidden lore. We aren't alone in this cosmos. We aren't even alone on this planet, as anyone who's met a blue Hades can attest. There's a reason all those domed undersea cities of the future never got built in the 1950s. And don't get me started on Deep Seven, the lurkers in the red-hot depths. But our neighbors, the Deep Ones and the Thonians, are adapted for wildly different biospheres. There is no colonial overlap to bring us to the point of conflict, which is a very good thing, because the result would be a very rapid game over, humans lose. The things that keep me awake in the small hours aren't anything like as approachable as a Deep One. Hell, I've worked with a Deep One, left a part of my soul behind with her. No matter. The things that terrify me are blue-green worms, twisting and coiling luminous intrusions glimpsed in the abruptly emptied eyes of a former colleague. Minds patient and incomprehensibly old that find amusement in our tortured writhing. Boltzmann brains from the chaotic, necrotic depths of the distant future, reaching back through the thinning ultrastructure of space-time to idly toy with our reality. Things that go bump in the night eternal. Things that eat us. There is a fourth and final philosophy by which some of us live our lives, and it boils down to this. Do not go quietly into that dark night. Draw a fourth circle on that now crowded Venn diagram, and you'll see that while it intersects the greedy and authoritarian circles, and even has a tiny overlap with the greedy authoritarian bit, it doesn't quite intersect with the third circle, the worshippers. It holds up a mirror to their self-destruction. Call it the circle of the necromantic apostates. That's where I stand, whether I'm greedy or authoritarian or both. I don't think I'm either, but how can I be sure? I may believe in mind-eating horrors from beyond space-time, but they'll have to break my neck before I bend it to their yoke. Keep telling yourself that, Bob. Mo carries her violin and follows Dr. Williams as he picks up a chipped plywood tea tray and backs through a swinging door, carrying the jar of paperclips and the stapler. The glass window in the door is hazed by a fine wire mesh, and the edges of the door are lined with copper fingers that close against a metal strip inside the frame. Williams places the tray on one end of an optical workbench, then bolts the door and flips a switch connected to a red lamp outside his office.
"You've worked with one of these before?"
he asks.
"Of course."
Mo shrugs out of her jacket and hangs it on a hook.
"It's the entanglement retrieval bit I'm unfamiliar with. That, and I may need a lab report. I know my limits."
"Good."
Williams's smile is humorless.
"Then if I tell you to stay in the isolation grid over there, you know what the consequences are for getting things wrong."
"Indeed."
She opens the violin case and removes her bone-white instrument and its bow. Williams stares at it for a moment.
"Do you really need that?"
"When I said they're targeting me, I wasn't exaggerating. Besides, the document they stole was a report on this very instrument. If they're trying to backtrack from it to find the original, then when you bring up the Adams Tote resonance, it might lead them here."
Dr. Williams snorts.
"I'm sure the front desk will be very happy to see them."
He turns to the bench and unclamps a swinging arm, uses it to position a glass diffraction grating in a path defined by a set of curious pentagonal prisms positioned at the 10 vertices of an irregular pentacle.
"Would you pass me the data logger? It's the second one along on the top shelf."
It takes Dr. Williams a quarter of an hour to set up the forensic magician's workbench. Apart from the odd geometric layout, it doesn't resemble the popular imagination's picture of a sorcerer's laboratory. Coloured chalk lines and eye of newt are gone, replaced by solid-state lasers and signal generators. Pointy hats and robes have given way to polarized goggles and lab coats. The samples, stripped of their containers, are transferred to windowed containers using Perspex tongs. Williams slots them into place in the observation rig.
"Okay, stations," he says conversationally. "I haven't modified the beam line, so there should be no overspill, but I'll run a low power test first, just in case."
Mo and the forensic demonologist move to stand inside complex designs inlaid in the floor in pure copper.
"How's your personal ward?" he asks.
Mo reaches for the fine silver chain around her neck.
"Mine's fine," she says slowly. "Damn, I should have drawn a spare for Bob.